The topic of my talk this morning is limiting beliefs about Buddhism. So it's not necessary to be a Buddhist to practice reflective meditation, though the practice is based within Buddhist teachings. I became interested in meditating, but also in Buddhism in the late 90s. I was raised Catholic. I'd then gone through a period of New Age consciousness in the 80s with probably some other people on this call. And then had a deep interest in Eastern philosophies and took a deep dive into Taoism. And then found Buddhist teachings, like I said, in the late 90s, and really do consider myself a Buddhist now. The teachings really took hold of me, and with mindfulness being such a global phenomenon, Anne Gleig coined a word, convert Buddhist, which may be even what I would be considered now. And I find this a very rich topic of contemplation of our trajectory in spiritual teachings, in religious teachings, and in the search for a practice that we identify with and we want to stay with for a while. And there is this debate about Buddhism, whether it's a religion or a philosophy, a way of life. But either way, I think there's limiting beliefs within Buddhism. And a recent article by Witten Higgins in the Secular Buddhist Network, which is an online forum, he outlines a few of those beliefs. And I just came across them in my reading the other day and thought I would pick up a few of them that have affected me. And what's curious about these beliefs to me, which is that they were really predominant in the culture when I came into Buddhism, and that things have changed from the 90s. The Buddhist movement is different, very different. More things have been translated, there's more teachers, there's more debate about the teachings, there's more unity about the teachings. But because this is going on in the larger realm, it's also affected my own views about Buddhism and what I came to Buddhism with. And I see a really strong connection between our limiting beliefs or views and the time period we live in, as well as the family we were born in. They're not just in a vacuum. We didn't just get born with them and then, nothing else affected them. But this limiting belief, I'll start with this that Winton names. He says monastics, celibate monks and nuns, and their practice take precedence over lay people and their practice. Now that was interesting to me. I didn't even know kind of the terms monks and nuns. I was still in kind of priests and congregates or atheist and nothing. I really wasn't familiar with what even was a lay person. It was something that was terminology I didn't use. But it was something that the Buddha was both. He had been born into a family and was a lay person and left the lay life to become a monk. And there was a sense of that trajectory of leaving lay life and going into a monastic tradition, that's where you would find liberation. And that even though there was some credence given to lay people, it was really the path was leaving the lay life. But then many ascetics thought the Buddha wasn't holy enough, and a lot of lay people thought he was a god. So it was very confusing reading the suttas and trying to, get a little bit deeper dive into the Buddha's life. And was he a person? Was he a god? Did it matter to people? Some people, this wasn't even a question. But I was very interested in the findings and how Buddhism developed, the findings of the Buddhist life. But one of the things that really struck me was his teaching on conditionality, and I hadn't heard this teaching in other traditions. So I thought this is something that's special, that's unique, and it's a powerful change agent. And I found that in my life. But at the same time, the Buddha also didn't do things that I considered were, very wise. He left a young wife and a newborn. He talked about the teachings being limited by women practicing them, and other things that when I read, I was like, this is not really something, of a higher realm. And the more I read, more that became available, I could see that he lived a rich and deep and complex life. And he became more human to me. And this was also supported by the direction of my growing up in Buddhism. Stephen Batchelor wrote a book called After Buddhism, where he has a narrative and translation and alternate understandings of the Buddha's lives. The characters become much more real and much more human in their interactions and the choices that they made. And a lot of his research paralleled the Christian tradition that was looking into Christ's life and trying to find the human behind the God and look at the person within the teachings. Now, that's a really interesting direction because part of Buddhism is go opposite, not find the person in the teachings, go into a not self or trying to put the teachings as something different than the person. But I find this is also a very deep area of contemplation of how we get teachings from teachers that are human, and the teachings are considered pure, and the human is considered warped or warped. I don't know if humans are considered warped. I always have to kind of laugh at myself with some of the terms that pop out of my mouth. But are more conditioned, that the teachings are pure and that the human is conditioned. And I've come to see more that the teachings are conditioned too, that they have their own limiting beliefs within them. So with this direction of looking at how Buddhism gets passed along, transmitted, and translated, I think that for some of us, it's been helpful to have the teachers, their superpowers reduced, that they actually are more like us, that there's a way that their development comes from being human, and that it's something that we can also develop within ourselves, and that it's not so much outside our range. It can be mysterious, can be we don't know how we'd get there. But I think that developmental process, considering that for teachers as well as people who are studying, really made a difference in my trajectory. So the other statement that Winton brings in is that monks and nuns have been inappropriate role models for people living in the complex worldly life as householders. And that's something I hadn't really thought of before. Is a monk or a nun an inappropriate role model? I think it's so unique for each of us. But it is something that I wouldn't have dared say at some point. So there's a sense of even considering what's a good role model for you. Is a celibate monk who lives in a different country, in monastic conditions, is that a good role model for you? Is that somebody you can learn from? Do you need somebody, a teacher who's more like you to learn? I think this is a good area for us to consider. And so within writing our book, I had really talked about the refuge of the Buddha as being, the spiritual teacher. And that's kind of what I'm considering our limiting views around teachers in Buddhism. So I'll read my final paragraph and end here today. It was a big leap for me to believe that I had the capacity for awakening as a person, as a teacher, as a Buddha. It was easier to project superhuman characteristic onto teachers. How could I ever live up to or develop the wisdom of them? Given this perspective, disillusionment was inevitable. The only choice left for me was to rely on my own experience for my questions and my concerns to take center stage. Awakening would have to look different for me than my teachers. I don't have a teacher now. I have a group of teachers that I'm accountable to. This practice of meditating, questioning, reflection, and conversation is my refuge. That's where I go when I feel pain, hurt, happiness, joy, etc. My refuge in the Buddha has become a middle way between having one teacher and no teacher. So, thank you for listening this morning. We'll now do our practice together. We'll have half an hour to meditate, then a little bit under 10 minutes to reflect. I'll ring the bells. Welcome to anybody that may be new this morning.